This is the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 27th, 2015. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Any use of this material without the express written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated is prohibited. Let's go ahead and take a look at what happened here in the final week of April and discuss the cases that have come down, cases and other developments that came down this week. We're going to begin with a case for a taxpayer victory in this case, the case of Resson versus Commissioner. And it's a tax court summary opinion 2015-32. And this is an interesting case because it deals with something that we have to deal with quite often. That is the proper documentation of a taxpayer related to the business use of an auto. In this case, Mr. Resson was a construction manager with a construction company. And he had a number of jobs off away from home. So he lived away from home a pretty good part of the year, all but 1.5 months of the year. And for that, he took a fifth wheel with him along with a truck. So those two went out to the job sites. Now, during the year, he had two different pickup trucks that were involved. So there are two trucks in here. His employer paid him a per diem for lodging. His employer was willing to pay for airfare to job sites, but it would not pay for him to have a vehicle. So what he did instead was he essentially drove to the job sites with the fifth wheel, then stayed at the job site during the week, right, returning home on weekends and that sort of thing. Now, based on this, he claimed 100% business use for his trucks. And it was not an insignificant deduction because the claimed auto expense deduction based on mileage for the year was $28,504. Now, he did not have a formal log per se, but he did have a calendar where he essentially kept track of his jobs. He essentially kept track of where he was, what he was doing. He had the details of the actual use of which vehicle he was using, the beginning mileage, the ending. So while it wasn't something labeled an auto log, it was something very close. The IRS, though, felt that this was not adequate, so they challenged him in court. The tax court decided that, in fact, Mr. Resson, through going back to his calendar, getting the mileage beginning and end, and working up what he did while on job sites, was good enough documentation of business use. Now, one question you might have, and I had when I read this case initially, was why in the world did this even get to the tax court? Because it seems like Mr. Resson should have, you know, had a pretty easy time. Seems like a key reason, maybe a hint the court gave us, when they tell us that the notice was issued when communications broke down with the agent. Don't know what that means. It may be code for the fact that the agent and the taxpayer had a falling out, the taxpayer didn't like the agent, whatever happened, they basically stopped communicating, shall we say, whatever happened, and the notice was issued, and for whatever reason, the IRS was not inclined moving forward. They stated that it didn't provide adequate documentation. Now, the interesting aside in the case is that the court does a pretty good job in this case, which is why it's useful to reference, of walking you through exactly the sort of thing a client should have in order to document auto use. Also crucial in this case, which I think made a huge difference in making Mr. Resson believable, was that despite the fact that the IRS's attorney questioned him in detail regarding what he did with the truck, how he did it, and the information, except for a couple of minor issues, which the court was okay, they figure there's always going to be minor discrepancies that they'll talk about, but there was no major difference between what Mr. Resson stated happened and what his log showed and his position during the entire case. Mr. Resson, most importantly, was believable. That makes a huge difference when you're looking at whether you can carry out, when you're going to get a victory in the tax court. Next, we move on to the case of Rogers versus Commissioner, an appeal to the D.C. Circuit, which is docket number 13-1241, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit of a tax court opinion that came down earlier. This dealt with a flight attendant for United Airlines. This flight attendant is a U.S. citizen, but she was assigned to work out of Hong Kong, her place of, basically, her port that she was assigned to that she was supposed to work out of. So that's the airport she works out of. And she lived in Hong Kong. She claimed a 100% foreign earned income exclusion. for all of her wages from United Airlines. The IRS protested that, in fact, a very limited portion of her wages qualified for the foreign earned income exclusion. And walking through this is an interesting discussion about what exactly qualifies. Now, the IRS pointed out, and the tax court took note of, that the airline had provided Ms. Rogers with an apportionment of her estimated duty time based on her minutes spent in and over foreign countries, over international waters, and in and over the United States. And only a minority of her time was actually in foreign airspace or in foreign countries. The IRS conceded that her time there was fine, but the IRS argued no other time counted. The taxpayer countered by arguing that, well, no, since my base of assignment is Hong Kong, that should be where it is deemed I provide the services. The Court of Appeals agreed with the tax court that essentially, no, where you provide the services is literally where you provide them. It does not have to do with where your duty station is. Basically, the regulations interpret that as meaning physical location where the service is performed. The court found that was a reasonable interpretation of the ruling, and in fact pointed out that the taxpayers had never actually claimed the regulation was invalid, so the court felt we were done. Now, the one thing to point out here, sometimes if you don't deal with the foreign earned income credit often, you may get a little confused saying, well, I thought you just had to live outside the United States, and it had to be services outside the U.S. No, it must be services in a foreign country. And the problem with that is, we had this a couple of years ago with the Antarctica cases, and we have it here with international waters. International waters, and just in case you were concerned, Antarctica, are not areas under control of a foreign government, under the jurisdiction of a foreign government. You have to perform your services in an area under the jurisdiction of a foreign government in order to qualify for the foreign earned income exclusion. Therefore, in this case, she had to only apportion her time when she was in foreign airspace or actually in Hong Kong performing services or in another country other than the U.S. But any time over international waters, and obviously if you're if you're a flight attendant flying international flights in the Pacific, you're going to spend a lot of time over international waters. That time is going to be fully taxable by the U.S. with no exclusion, no foreign earned income exclusion allowed to you for any amount you're paid for that time. Next, let's move on to the case of Leota C. Matthews, APC, versus Commissioner TC, Memorandum Decision 2015-78. This case is actually an equivalent case to the case a few weeks ago of Medical Weight Control Specialist versus Commissioner TC, Memo 2015-52. And the interesting part about this and why I bring this up, although we discussed that a couple weeks ago back in March when this case came up, I bring it up now because this is a second case with the same issue. That's important because it means the IRS is apparently very aware of this issue and, in fact, is using this issue in their favor. What's the problem here? If you remember that case from the Medical Weight Control Specialist case, here's the issue. A California corporation can have its rights suspended if it fails to pay the franchise tax. The Franchise Tax Board can suspend its privileges. While the law allows the privileges to be retroactively reinstated, the IRS contended and the tax court agreed that you can't retroactively reinstate the right to have filed a suit. That is not, under California law, something that can be reinstated. If a corporation attempts to file suit during that time or attempts to file in court, a court petition during that time, that is invalid. Why is that important? Well, let's think about the types of taxpayers that are going to run into this problem. You have a corporation that's behind in its taxes. If it's behind in its taxes to the feds, there's a decent chance it's behind in its taxes to the state. The Franchise Tax Board will pull the trigger on this and suspend privileges. When that happens, if the IRS issues a notice of determination of the corporation, that's still valid. You know, they issue the 90-day letter, that's still valid. However, the corporation does not have the ability to file a petition in tax court to challenge that now because any petition it files is invalid. This is the second taxpayer that tried to take its IRS issue to court and never had its day in court because it had no right to file a petition. The retroactive reinstatement did not work. This may be the sort of thing, depending upon how much money there is with the people who are raising the challenge, that we might see taken to the Ninth Circuit, simply because obviously it will be a big deal for California corporations. But I should warn you, the tax court position here, you need to be aware that even if you're not in California, you have to be sure that your corporation has the right to pursue litigation. And if your corporation has allowed their charter to lapse, or if you have a statute in your state like California that allows the state to remove the corporation's rights based on the failure to pay tax. And remember, corporations are an invention of the state. Therefore, not surprisingly, the state takes the position that if you don't pay them, they have the right to basically suspend your rights because you're a total creation of them. So yeah, that's a concern. That the IRS is now aware and looking at that. The problem, of course, is the taxpayer has effectively no recourse unless they can get themselves back in a position to file suit within the 90 days. That may have an impact all through the system because if the IRS is aware of that, they're aware they can push forward with little chance of litigation. So be aware, warn your clients about these problems, and also you may want to check into your applicable state law to see if you have a similar state revenue statute that could cause a problem like this. Now, the IRS, of course, gained a deal in court that way, but the tax court doesn't always rule the way the IRS likes on these sorts of issues. And the case of Yuska versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-77, it was the IRS that was told that their action was invalid in this case because they didn't dot the I's and cross the T's properly, or more importantly, they failed to pay attention to something that happened. In the case of Yuska versus Commissioner, the IRS had essentially issued a notice to the taxpayer that they had issued a notice of intent to lien on a balance that was due. The taxpayer owed the IRS money. The taxpayer, at that point, filed a request, basically, for a hearing. And the IRS, essentially at this point, said that essentially they filed a petition for the right to review, to do a collections due process review of the lien. Following that filing, but before the IRS actually ruled in the case as to whether the IRS was going to proceed with the lien or not, the taxpayer filed a petition in bankruptcy court. The IRS denied the taxpayers claim that the lien should not be done, and they issued a notice of determination concerning collection action and said essentially, yes, we can go ahead and move forward. The lien has been filed and the taxpayer essentially, you know, we deny your challenge. The taxpayer filed with the tax court asking the tax court to review that denial. Now the IRS, just like they did in the prior case here, went back and said, hey, wait, these guys have no right to sue because there's an automatic stay that applies to actions such as this for bankruptcy. And the problem with that is that the 90-day period has no stay. So the problem is the 90-day period would still expire even though the taxpayer would not have a right to file this petition. So the IRS wants it dismissed, and when it's dismissed, essentially, then the taxpayer would have no right to refile because by the time this got before the court, the 90-day period was over and the bankruptcy continued, the stay was in place. The tax court said, well, you know, we kind of agree the bankruptcy means we can't really deal with this case right now. But IRS, we don't agree that the taxpayer is the one with the problem here. We state that your issuance of a notice of determination concerning collection activity after the automatic stay was filed is itself the problem in this case. That is considered to be a collection activity that the automatic stay stops. The court pointed to the fact that they had previously issued a notice on this point that in the Smith case, and this was the case of Smith versus Commissioner, which is 124 TC 36, that in a levy case, the tax court had ruled just like this. The IRS cannot issue a notice of determination. The IRS said, aha, but this is a lien case. And, you know, and look at it. In another lien case that we had, which the IRS was dealing with, they said, look, in a secondary lien case that you issued, Prevost versus Commissioner 120C TC 327, in the lien case, you indicated that, no, we were not prohibited from moving forward. But the tax court said, IRS, here's your problem. It was not the difference between lien and levy that caused the difference between the Smith case and the Prevost case. Rather, the problem was the exact sequence of events. In Prevost, the IRS issued the notice of determination, while still clearly, basically, they issued the notice of determination. After the notice was issued, the taxpayer filed a bankruptcy petition. And then after that was filed, the taxpayer filed his attempt to dispute that denial in tax court. The tax court said there was the problem. In that case, we had a valid IRS notice of determination, followed by a bankruptcy filing by the taxpayer, which then prohibited the taxpayer from protesting the action, and because there is nothing in the code that provides for an extension of the 90-day period in that provision, the taxpayer just could never challenge at the end of the bankruptcy. When the stay is lifted, he still can't file a challenge. In this case, the tax court said, here's the difference. IRS, you had to stop and not issue the notice of termination once the bankruptcy came. So that's thrown out. Therefore, that has never been issued. Therefore, the event that the taxpayer is allowed to protest has never happened, and you still are stayed from doing anything. So assuming we finish all this, or the bankruptcy petition is dismissed, or whatever happens when the stay is gone and this issue is still in play, the IRS would have to issue its notice at that point, after which the taxpayer could then petition the tax court. So while the court is dismissing it, the key difference, as the court pointed out, was whether following this dismissal, the taxpayer would still have the right to protest this later, or whether the taxpayer simply is out of luck. And the court said, no, the taxpayer is not out of luck in this case. Finally, let's look at Chief Counsel Advice 2015-17005. This is the second case we've had in recent weeks dealing with the issue of the statute of limitations for claiming NOL carrybacks. In this case, what we had was a taxpayer who apparently, and the advice actually talks about 13 years of returns and talks them in reverse order. So I'm going to kind of give you the basics here. The taxpayer went back, looked at a return they filed 9 years earlier where they claimed a foreign tax credit. Now, under a special provision of the code, which is section 6511D3, a special exception to the 3-year statute that's normally 26511A, remember, you have 3 years to file a claim for refund. So if you're asking for money back, you have 3 years from the date the return was filed. And obviously, if you file before April 15th, then we move it to April 15th for an individual. Or if no return was filed, 2 years from the date the tax was paid. Or you have, you know, basically, that's when you have to file your claim. Well, this was a 9-year-old return. Well, under this special provision of D3, if you have a limitation, if you have a period of limitation, if a claim for credit or refund for overpayment related to those taxes is made within 10 years, there's now they substitute a 10-year period for the 3-year period. So we get a 10-year period for the assessment. So the for the claim. So the taxpayer had the right. The taxpayer went back and changed because when the taxpayer changed, that dropped his taxable income dramatically, not surprisingly, and more than made up for, at least presumably made up for, the loss of the foreign tax credit. In fact, it so much decreased taxable income that now the taxpayer had a net operating loss. So the taxpayer, again, they did not ask to carry the loss forward, and actually that wouldn't have helped, as we'll discover in this case anyway, but in any event, they're required to carry it back 2 more years. So the taxpayer carried the loss back 2 years to year 11. The IRS now was asked, the agent was asking, well, can they do that? And the IRS pointed out, the chief counsel's office went back to the section we discussed a couple weeks ago, 6511D2A, that is a special rule for net operating losses. That rule says, unfortunately, that it has to be basically 3 years from the due date, including extensions of the return generating the NOL. Well, that NOL return had a due date that was basically 10 years ago. And 3 years to that, we're still way beyond that three-year date when we're filing for NOL. The taxpayer said, wait, wait. See, what we think the problem is that really this is a claim relating to foreign taxes. And so because of that, we should get the special 10-year statute, and they would be within that statute. The National Office disagreed. It raised a few issues. First, it said it felt that the loss really in question was came from the NOL. So that's a different problem. And the NOL statute should control. It was not directly. The foreign taxes may have led to the NOL, but they're not all in the NOL. Secondly, the court said, even if we accept your view on that, or I should say not the court, but the National Office said, NOL is composed of all kinds of different things. And at best, if you accepted this, which the National Office clearly does not, the National Office said you would only get the portion that would be related to the foreign taxes that are contained in the NOL. The National Office went on to say that, of course, basically, therefore, there is only the three-year statute. What that reminds us of, we're seeing the National Office taking a very strict position. If you have these unusual open statute rules and they lead to an NOL, remember the National Office position is generally you're still going to be stuck with that very narrow three-year rule. Getting 10 years on the nine-year-old return does not somehow get you that extra time for the NOL. Rather, the way the NOL statute's written, the way the claim statute's written, it only gets you 3 years from the due date of the return for which the foreign taxes were paid. And as we say in this case, that was way, way long ago. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April 27, 2015. Be sure to join us next week as we talk about more taxes involved in this and what's been updated. Also, visit us at our website, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, for information regarding updates, also for details on the cases we discussed this week, as well as updates during the week as cases come down and new information comes down. Thank you for listening to this week's broadcast.